Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. This week, I do? Let me think about that. With the U.S. Supreme Court ruling against Proposition 8 and overturning the Defense of Marriage Act in June, same-sex couples can now legally marry in California, and the federal government will recognize those marriages. There are rewards and there are risks. To take advantage of the rewards, including tax breaks for the full year, you must be married by the end of this year. There are also many implications for family law, parental rights, and child custody issues, especially for families that move to another state, and divorce issues. My guests advise, don't miss an opportunity, but don't rush into anything either. Chuck Tuxera graduated from Harvard Law School and has an advanced degree in tax law from New York University. He has practiced in San Francisco for more than 30 years, concentrating on employee benefits and estate planning, including matters such as the division of pensions on divorce and the structure of distributions upon death. Chuck has lectured and published widely. He's served as chair of the tax section of the Bar Association of San Francisco and has been an adjunct faculty member at the Aguino School of Business at Golden Gate University. Chuck, welcome to Out in the Bay. Emily Dosko has been practicing law in the Bay Area since 1989. She was among the first wave of lawyers to represent lesbian parents and second parent adoptions and has completed or helped clients complete for themselves well over 300 second-parent and domestic partner adoptions. She is a member of the National Center for Lesbian Rights National Family Law Advisory Council. A graduate of Bolt Hall Law School of Berkeley, Emily spent years litigating cases on behalf of HIV and cancer patients wrongly denied insurance benefits and on behalf of women and girls who suffered sexual abuse by landlords, teachers, doctors, and therapists. She now focuses on exclusively on family law, including mediation, collaborative practice, and services for the LGBTQI community. Welcome, Emily.
Hi, Eric.
So let's just throw it out there. Why would anyone want to get married? It seems like with these recent court decisions, we've been encouraged to look at marriage in terms of it as a civil contract for the financial and legal implications, at least as much as for romance, if not more. So I want to ask you both, do you get a sense that same-sex couples have been rushing into marriage since the decisions in June? There certainly was a push at City Hall Pride weekend right after these decisions were announced.
I would say yes. A lot of people have been marrying in haste since the decisions came out, same as a lot of people married in 2008 with the awareness that the window for marriage was likely to close, as it did. So there's sort of, at this point, I would say there's sort of a backlog of people from, you know, November of 2008 until the Windsor decision who have been waiting to be able to marry in California and now are doing it. And then there are a lot of people who are just kind of, woohoo, we can get married. Let's go do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Chuck, from your side, are you seeing, as we spoke on the phone earlier, there are some advantages if for certain people to do this before the end of the year, because then you will get some tax advantages for the full year. Are you seeing people like going like, oh, gosh, I got to hurry up and do this before the end of the year?
No, I'm really not seeing people rush into marriage at all. But it is true that if you want the advantages of being able to file your 1040 for 2013 with the status of married filing jointly, you do have to be married and living together by the end of this year. And for a couple with a substantial income from a one earner in the family, the married filing jointly is a very advantageous status to have. It just really, you could reduce your taxes if there's something like $400,000 coming in from one breadwinner. You can reduce your taxes by about $25,000 by filing married instead of filing married individually.
So that's from both the family law and the tax standpoints. Let's talk about, that's a great, obviously a primary advantage. Are there other primary advantages for getting married?
Well, it depends. For people who are already registered domestic partners, the shift in taxation is really the biggest issue. Also, the ability to sponsor a spouse for a green card is a big issue. But for people who are already registered, they already have the benefits in California, right? The state.
So let's clear that up. So if someone's registered with the state as domestic partners, that in California has the same exact legal effect as marriage does.
Right.
But it's only now that the federal government is now recognizing the marriages, but they're not recognizing domestic partnerships. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
So registered domestic partners who want the federal tax advantages definitely want to get married by the 31st. And I would say, in answer to your question, I am seeing a lot of people coming in and saying, we got to get married by the 31st. We need our prenup.
Okay. Uh-huh. We'll talk about prenups a little more in depth very soon. So we've talked a little bit about some of the primary advantages. Beyond the tax stuff, what about, adoption, not adoption, but parental rights, any kind of other legalization of the relationship status, like hospital visitation rights, things like that. As you said, in California, it's all the same. But if someone moves to another state, what are the issues there?
Well, if someone moves to a state where they're a non-recognition state, I'm not sure I'm totally following your question.
It probably wasn't
question.
The best worded question. But are there...
Because it differs whether it has to do with marriage or whether it has to do with divorce or whether it has to do with parentage or, in what way they're interacting with the federal government is what determines whether moving to a non-recognition state matters.
Okay. So there's three levels here. There's people who are maybe couples, but they're not domestic partners yet. And there's people who are couples that are domestic partners but aren't married yet. So there's a couple of decisions. You can go from not being domestic partner to being married, and you can go from being a domestic partner couple to being married. So let's take some more concrete stuff. Let's talk about the so-called marriage penalty. When I was covering Minnesota State House in the late 1990s, now this is about 14 years ago, conservative politicians were complaining about the marriage penalty, saying that tax law was penalizing married couples or discouraging single couples, especially older couples who learned a lot from getting married because they would pay much more in taxes. So for you, Unchuck, first, what truth is there in that? And to the extent that it is true, does the same hold for same-sex couples?
Well, it would... Couples who are married, whether they're same-sex or opposite sex, I mean, the tax law is going to be the same for them now through marriage. I think, about people, working people, often called the working poor, about there are some disadvantages. And one that I had wanted to talk about a little bit was the earned income tax credit. A tax credit is important because for every dollar of the credit, you reduce your tax liability. So it's worth more than a deduction, which only reduces your tax liability by your marginal rate. So if your marginal rate is 40%, you reduce your tax liability by 40 cents instead of by a dollar. But if a couple is married, for example, and they have one person brings a child, two children, and the other partner brings one child, and they file a joint return, they have to file a joint return if they're married to get the earned income tax credit. But the maximum tax credit they can get is a little over $6,000. But if the same couple is not married, the maximum tax credit they can receive is $8,600. It's about $2,600 more, and that's significant. Now, right now, the earned income tax credit is being attacked by some people in Congress. It's just important to know that it's a refundable credit. So if your tax liability isn't as high as the credit, you get the credit back as cash.
Like the old days of the renter's credits. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's being attacked now because some people in Congress are saying that 25 cents of every dollar refunded through the tax credit goes to people that doesn't deserve it, people who don't deserve it. So it's worth about $40 billion a year in refunds, but it is under attack now. Also, if you're married, the level of income at which the tax credit begins to be phased out is much lower than if you're not married but have the same number of children.
Now, as far as the tax advantages you were talking about at the beginning, is there a magic number in terms of the income level above or below which it's better to marry or not in terms of the tax consequences? You talked about low-income families just now with the earned income tax credit. But is there like a sort of like, okay, you've got your stereotypical gay couple, double income, no kids, and you said it's better, the tax advantage is more pronounced when there's only one breadwinner instead of two.
That's right.
But is there like a sort of like, okay, if we're making over, say, $200,000, we need to worry or think about this more than if we're making, $80,000?
No, I don't see that, but I do think that there's more exposure if you have over $200,000, though you don't reach the highest marginal tax rates until you're over $400,000 now, but the penalty is not, it's just not like one single consoling consideration about whether you're going to marry or not. I mean, you have to look at your particular circumstances with children or without children. Is it primarily investment income that you're getting, or is it personal services income? So there's not, people just have to really look at their situation.
Mm-hmm. Emily, when people come into you, what kinds of questions are they bringing to you most?
Well, to some extent, they're tax questions. It's the same question you just asked. You know, is it to our tax advantage to marry? Is it going to make a difference in our parenting situation? Is it, do we have to share our income? A lot of times when people come into me before they're getting married, it's because they want to consider whether to do a prenup. And so to that extent, their question is, what does the law say? And what are the advantages and disadvantages to just going with the law, not using a prenuptial agreement, as opposed to making our own financial arrangements by developing an agreement?
Okay, so let's talk about prenuptials a little bit.
Yeah.
Why would some people want or need that protection?
Well,
say somebody's pressuring me to marry them. I'm like, well, wait a minute. And on the one hand, you think, well, now we're covered by the state. We don't have to think about all that stuff.
There's a lot of different reasons. I think so. I had a client on Friday who has been with his partner for 15 years. They've never cared about getting married. They've never wanted to get married or intended to get married. And then the partner inherited some money and something else financial happened that made them see that the tax advantages to them of getting married were significant. So they were planning to marry before December 31st, and he came in and I said, well, when's your wedding planned for? And he said, don't call it a wedding. I hate weddings. We're only getting married. We're not sentimental about this at all. It's purely for practical reasons. And so there, for them, they wanted a prenup that said, we're not going to go under California law. We're going to continue with the same financial arrangements we've always had, which is our income is separate. Our earnings are separate. Our savings are separate. But we want this status because it gives a tax advantage to the partner.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. My guests are family law attorney Emily Dosko and tax lawyer Chuck Texera. We're talking about same-sex marriage. Now that it's legal, should you or shouldn't you? And should you do so before the end of the year? We'll be back in just half a minute.
Out in the Bay is supported in part by the Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral and Information Service, providing legal referrals in over 100 areas of the law, including those most relevant to the LGBT community. Information online at sfbar.org/LRIS or by phone at 415-989-1616.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Eric Jansen. My guests are family law attorney Emily Dosko and tax lawyer Chuck Texera. So we talked just very briefly, and I want to talk about more about the state of residency, or Chuck, as you were saying, the state of celebration. These are two different – are they the same concepts? Or are they two different ones? Because there's a difference in tax law than there is in some of the family law issues?
Well, it has to do with all the different federal agencies, actually. So when DOMA was declared unconstitutional, what it said was that the federal government now is going to recognize marriages, same-sex marriages. But recognize is an interesting word. So, for example, the IRS has a rule that says they'll recognize marriages based on the place of celebration, so where the marriage was entered into. If you have a valid marriage, then the IRS will treat you as married for tax purposes, even if you live in North Carolina. But Social Security has a rule that says that benefits are based on your place of domicile. So you may have a valid marriage that you entered into in California or New York or any of the 14 other states or the District of Columbia. But if you live in North Carolina, you are not necessarily eligible for Social Security benefits because your place of residence does not recognize your marriage.
Even though you're recognized for other things. So do you have any sense of how the federal government is, which agencies are following this and which ones are not?
Well, Eric,
if I could
Chuck, please.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to say was that the Department of Labor has followed the Internal Revenue Service in, you know, treating marriages based on where it was celebrated. If where you married, recognized same-sex marriages, doesn't make any difference where you live. And that's an important thing, especially for pension plans and 401k plans and other kinds of employee benefits, because there's such a great overlap between the tax law and federal labor law called ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, that gives substantive rights for participants in plans and their spouses. And so it's kind of important in my area of law that they have the same definition of where you're going to look to see if someone is married and it's the place of celebration. And I did just want to say one more thing about that. There's some unsettled issues about in the employee benefits area, the pension area, that when employers in the past didn't recognize same-sex marriages, and so that benefits that a spouse would have received, the participant was able to give to somebody else, or the spouse was same-sex spouse was not able to get at all. There, we don't know yet how much litigation there's going to be when participants or their spouses now sue employers to get benefits they should have received had their same-sex marriages been recognized. Mm-hmm. It's actually a place that's really fraught with litigation potential right now. And I'm not sure how it's going to handle, but the Department of Labor doesn't seem to have told employers that as long as they acted in good faith, they're not going to be liable to pay a benefit again to a same-sex spouse that they paid to somebody else.
Emily, mm-hmm. you're nodding your head in agreement. Do you have anything to add to that?
I just wanted to go back to the place of domicile, place of celebration issue and say that I think the Social Security Administration is getting a lot of pushback on its decision to go with place of domicile rather than celebration. And I think that ultimately pretty much all the federal agencies are going to come around to a place of celebration because it's so incredibly complicated otherwise to deal with claims.
Is there some like overarching authority over all the federal departments that could, besides President Obama, could just say, come on, it's get on the same page here?
Not really.
Not really.
Not
okay.
that I'm aware of.
Not that simple.
Yeah, okay. If only.
Fair enough. I'm curious to know here, you mentioned something about prior years in your labor talk, Chuck, and I'm also wondering here if can newly married couples amend prior years' taxes to get the savings that they should have been able to get if their marriage has been recognized by the federal government?
Well, actually, the big case, the Windsor case that led to the invalidation of DOMA was about a request for a tax refund of estate taxes paid. But none of the administrative pronouncements that the government has given in for taxes, the Internal Revenue Service, has said they were going to extend the time for a refund. And basically, the rule is that if you've paid a tax, you have 3 years from the time you file the return or 2 years from the time the tax is paid, whichever expires later. So if people did overpay because their marriage was not recognized, they have to move relatively quickly to apply for a refund.
So can you – how quickly? I mean, how
– Well, I mean, if people are – usually people, you know, they have tax withheld from their earnings or they pay estimated tax. But so people should say April 2014, you have 3 years. If you overpaid from 2011 – You'd better apply before April 4th of 2014 if you paid too much tax in 2011. 2012 is still open. You can apply for a refund in 2012 and then 2013, but there's no reason to overpay in 2013 because you can still structure your tax returns taking advantage of marriage.
Okay, very good. Now, I want to talk a little bit more. Emily, you do a lot of work on second parent adoptions.
Mm-hmm.
So even though people are married and in the state of California and other states that recognize marriages, their children will be the non-biological parent, the children will be theirs. But if they go to some other state, there's a problem. Can you talk about that?
Well, I guess what I would say about that is only that most attorneys still are recommending that people go ahead and do adoptions of their own children. So when a child is born in California into a registered domestic partnership or a marriage, the child is automatically the child of both parents. And when they travel to another state, they run the risk of that state to a non-recognition state. They run the risk that state's not going to recognize the parentage because it's based on the relationship that is not recognized. And so we still recommend doing an adoption, getting a judgment of a court that you can take with you and that's entitled to full faith and credit from that non-recognition state.
How much of a effort or ordeal is that to go through?
It's not, you know, given that relative to the fact that you shouldn't have to do it at all.
Yes.
it's not that bad. But it's one thing that's kind of funny about the advent of marriage is that there's been an adoption tax credit, as Chuck was saying. It's a credit, dollar for dollar credit. That's a permanent fixture of the tax code now that says that you can get a credit on your taxes for money that you paid toward an adoption. However, you cannot get that refund if you're adopting the child of your spouse. So step-parent adoptions are intended to be excluded. Uh-huh. For registered domestic partners, for years, people have been getting the credit because the IRS didn't treat same-sex domestic partners as spouses.
Right.
So that, what I've often called the lesbian loophole, is closing now for once people marry, then they are,
no
in fact, adopting the child
adoption
of their spouse, and there's no more tax credit.
Fair enough. Uh-huh. You know, how do you think, this is going a little bit off the track of the practical aspects here, but I'm curious to know how you think, both of you, our new right to marry has affected LGBT culture or might in the future?
I have something to say about that. I mean, if I, there's a thing I mentioned before about the status of married filing jointly. And if you marry file jointly, you know, you risk liability for tax crimes your spouse commits. So in the sense that joint several liability, if you know or have reason to know that your spouse may be concealing income or inflating deductions or doing some illegal things, then you could be exposed to personal liability even after your spouse leaves you. So I think that a practical thing about marriage is that there's so much more potential liability that people have to be careful about who they hook up with.
Yeah, that's always been true for very many reasons, hasn't it? And how do you think the new right to marry has affected the quality of our relationships? I know that's kind of going out there a little ways, but you know, you've heard, I've certainly met many people who have said, you know, I just thought this was a bunch of hooey, and you know, it didn't matter, marriage didn't matter to me, and now that I'm, but now we actually did it, and it's something felt something actually feels different now. And I'm just, you know, curious if you see that among the people that you work with in your offices.
I do. I see it quite a bit. I see people coming in and talking about how their families treat them really differently because they're married, and how they feel just sort of more a part of things. I think it's an interesting question. You know, one of the things I say to people who come in and say, should we marry, should we not marry, the right to marry is not the duty to marry. So I think a lot of people feel like, well, we can, so we should, like it's a political act. And I think we're still in this process of evolving to a place where same-sex couples can marry because it's the organic place in their relationship that they would marry, in the same way that has always been true for opposite sex couples, as opposed to rushing to do it because they're afraid it's going to be taken away, or doing it because it's a political statement, or doing it for some reason other than they've moved to a place in their relationship where they want to make that particular kind of commitment.
Right, right.
Oh, that's beautiful, Emily. That's a beautiful way to describe it. Really. Thank you.
Since we're talking about families, that just put this thing in my head about families of origin and real estate and homes. And that's been one of the areas where so many times in the past, I was just visiting friends this past weekend in Los Angeles, Long Beach, actually. And this friend of mine was telling me the story of the gay guys down the street. One of them died and the family member came in and they weren't married. So, you know, the family member came in and tried to, you know, claim that house and kick him out of his home. I mean, he eventually prevailed. But how important is that protection? Is marriage going to solve that problem or not?
I think marriage is going to solve that problem to a significant degree. Yeah, I think you're still going to have homophobic families who are going to come in and try to, deny the relationship and do what they can to impair the spouse's rights, but I think it's going to make an enormous difference.
Mm-hmm. And I think, too, I mean, certain ways of holding property are only available to married couples.
Right.
Community property is only available. And if somebody dies and the house, for example, was held as community property or the securities account was held as community property, and then there's going to be a step-up in basis for the entire amount, not just the half that was owned by the spouse that passed away. So marriage in that sense can really help couples. They hold their property as community property, which is available only to married couples. They get a great step-up in basis at death so that when the surviving spouse maybe sells the house or sells other things, they pay a lot less income tax because the basis of the property is equal to its fair market value, which is close to what it's going to sell at.
So my last question for both of you is, how does an initial session work with you? Suppose we have some listeners who are thinking like, oh boy, maybe I should talk to an attorney. Maybe I should get a prenuptial agreement. Maybe I should think about the tax consequences of getting married. Can you give me a little idea? Chuck, let's start with you if you don't mind. What happens when someone comes into your office, you know, first time? Are there some sort of very specific steps you lead them through?
Well, I think that it really depends on most of the clients that come to me are somewhat older. You know, they're not like young kids. And they have some property or some business. There's some business and they're concerned about that. And they're concerned both about marriage and about estate planning, especially if they're going to be a young child, and they want to take care of, you know, provide for the child in case the child becomes disabled or things like that. So we usually take a kind of inventory of what they have, what their property is, and what other situations they're in. Is there a previous marriage or something else that they may have liability for? It's that kind of thing, just trying to scope out the situation of the people who are coming in to get advice.
And Emily, what about you?
Kind of similar. I love it when people come in before they get married and want to find out what it means to them and how it's going to affect them. And so I love to give them that education. And then generally we'll talk about, well, what are your goals? What is it that you want to accomplish in a prenup, if that's what you want? Or just how do you want to deal with your financial life together? And then we can assess whether a prenup is necessary or whether they're going to just go under California marital law. So I feel very honored, actually, to talk to people at that point of transition in their lives as they're trying to make those decisions. And, it's a really hard thing for people to talk about money in relationship. And so when they come in to try to do that, I think it's a very powerful moment in their relationship. And it's kind of great to work with.
Thank you so much. Thank you both. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, Gay Radio from San Francisco. I want to thank my guests, family law attorney Emily Dosko and tax lawyer Chuck Texera. You can learn more about them and the issues they discussed on Emily's website, emilydosko.com. That's spelled, the last name is D-O-S-K-O-W. You can email Chuck at chuck@gelawgroup.com. We'll have those links on our website, too, outinthebay.org. Emily and Chuck, thanks so much for coming in to share your expertise.
Thank you.
Thanks, Eric.
If you missed part of this broadcast, you can hear the whole thing on our website, outinthebay.org. It should be up by about 8 o'clock tonight. You can also sign up there for free podcasts and get the Stitcher app. That's right, Stitcher, that lets you hear radio programs on mobile devices. You can also hear our most recent shows right on the site and about a dozen of our favorites from our 9 years on the air. That's right, 9 years in October. Out in the Bay is independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. We thank KALW for studio use and airtime. We've been producing Out in the Bay for 9 years, as I said, and as an independent production, not a KALW staff production. Out in the Bay does not receive any funds from KALW, so we need community support. It's easy and tax deductible on our website, outinthebay.org. Hit the donate button and make a contribution, big or small. Don't forget matching funds from your employer. Our theme music was composed and performed by San Francisco musician Holly Ann Mead. Learn more about Holly on her blog, hollymead.tumblr.com. We'd love to hear from you with segment suggestions, comments, and questions. Write to us, eric@outinthebay.com and marilyn@outinthebay.com. I'm Eric James. Thanks for listening.